can get to them, Grace Bible Church, all one word, .org. And there's a whole bunch of lessons out there. These and other lessons from other teachers. So there's all kinds of stuff out there if you want some other stuff as well. Well, let's review a little bit of what we've seen this morning for a few minutes. And then I'd like for us to kind of think a little bit, too, about after we review what we've seen, talk about the issue of why do we care? Why do we care about what we've seen? Who gives a hoot about what we see in this book if we're not going to experience it ourselves? And we're not going to experience it ourselves because the rapture will take us out of here before that happens. So why do we give a hoot about what's in this book? Well, what we've seen so far, well, I can just touch this. I don't have to use my laser. Everything from chapter 4 forward in the book is the future. Most of it has to do with this period here called the tribulation period. How long a period of time is it? There's a hint right there. Huh? Yeah, how do we know that? Where's that come from? Daniel chapter 9 is where we got that one. Yeah, that's Daniel's 70th week. Most of everything in the future is in that seven-year period in this book, actually chapters 4 through 19. There's a little bit more beyond the end of that tribulation period, and we'll look at all that before we're done. Well, we've been working our way through the chapter 6 through 10 here, and this section deals primarily with the events of this seven-year period of time. There are events that will take place, and then there are people and nations and tongues and kings that are discussed in there as well. We've been featuring the events, kind of paying attention to them. And they kind of fall out of, or they stem from, beginning events from a series of judgments that are known as seal judgments because they're associated with the breaking of seals. On this little, not a little scroll, but on a scroll of judgment that God the Father hands to God the Son, and God the Son starts breaking those seals one at a time. Now, I'm not sure how that works. Maybe it has to do with the way it rolls up and it's sealed, and then you roll it out some more and you hit another seal and you roll it out some more. I don't know, but something like that. And there are seven of those seals. The first four of them kind of are a package deal. They kind of go together. You feeling that air? That came on, didn't you? Okay, I'm feeling a little better too. Well, those first four seals are associated with riders and horses, different color horses. And riders are associated with those first four seals. And chapter 6, verse 8 tells us that those four riders are empowered to kill one-fourth of the earth's population with four different forms of judgment. Wars, pestilence, famine, and beasts. That's an odd deal, isn't it? Beast is going to kill a bunch of people. Well, one-fourth of the world's population is about 2 billion people. 2 billion people. That's 21 times more people than died in World War I and World War II added together. 21 times more. So those first four seals all have to do with war and the inevitable consequences of war, famine, pestilence. I don't know how the beasts get in the picture. It's just kind of a separate category. But at any rate, those first four kind of go together. And also there are earthquakes there as well. And the Lord talks about that in Matthew 24, that would be the characterization of the first half of the tribulation period. So this first half of the tribulation period, first 3.5 years, is the first six of those seals. So 3.5 years, the events are not extraordinarily out of our experience. They are out of our experience in terms of their magnitude and their extent. You've never seen warfare that kills 2 billion people in 3.5 years, but you've seen warfare. So you know a little bit about this, but boy, the magnitude is different than anything we've ever experienced before. So the first 3.5 years will be characterized by that form of death that will kill so much of the world's population. Then when we get down to the seventh seal, that kind of opens a Pandora's box of more judgments, seven more judgments. And they're associated with the sounding of trumpets, and so we call them the trumpet judgments. And the first four of those trumpet judgments, six seals, seventh seal is seven trumpet judgments, the seventh trumpet will be seven bowl judgments. Okay, so by the time it's all said and done, we're getting about 20 or to 21 judgments in this series of tribulation period judgments. But the first four of those trumpet judgments kind of go together like the first four of the seal judgments go. They all strike at the world's ecosystem. And four of them destroy one-third of the Earth's ability to sustain life. Something wipes out a third of the green vegetation on the planet, the ability to produce greenery and crops and things of that sort. One-third. One-third destroys the ocean's ability to sustain life and all the food that comes from the oceans and the support of the ocean activity. An object destroys a third of the fresh water supply on the planet. And a third of it destroys the celestial bodies that support the Earth's ecosystem. The sun, the moon, the gravitational fields of these bodies determine the tide movements and the way that water is, the hydrological cycle on the planet, the way water is evaporated and forms rain, falls back down the planet, all that stuff. So everything that the Earth uses to sustain life will be reduced by a third as a result of those first four trumpet judgments. What's that do to the shelves down at the Walmart? The food chain totally destroyed. You're not going to be able to get a lot of stuff. People are going to start stealing, robbing, killing, whatever they got to do to get food, because the Earth's ability to supply it is being destroyed. One-third of it goes away. That's the first four trumpet judgments. The next two trumpet judgments, trumpet number 5 and 6, they are given an additional label in Scripture called a woe. And we'll see in chapter 12, well, we jumped ahead and looked at that and then we came back, but woes are associated with demonic activity. So the trumpets 5 and 6 are demon activity. They originate in the bottomless pit. They have a demon over them. It's pretty clear to me that they are demon activity. One involves a little stinging critter about the size of a locust. Remember, we saw him last week. We saw a good picture of him. They torment men for 5 months. They don't kill men. They torment men for 5 months with a stinger. That is, they torment non-believers or those that don't have God's seal in their foreheads. But the second one of those woes is even more impressive. It's even more difficult to grasp. There's an army of 200 million horsemen, and those horses have heads like dragons and tails like serpents. They can kill you from the rear end and sting you with a black mamba for a tail, or they can burn you to death with blowing fire out of their mouths from the front. Who's ever seen anything like that? That's nothing we know anything about, is it? 200 million of them, and they kill also another one-third of the Earth, which at that time will be about another 2 billion people. Beg your pardon?
Another second third?
Yes. Well, the first one was a fourth. This one is a third. That's over half the world's population, but just those two judgments. And that means that each one of these things will have to kill about 10 people. Yeah, Jeff?
How do they get God's seal?
They're given it. Remember, there was a timeout called back in chapter 7, and the angel called timeout and said, hold on, don't do anything until we can seal God's servants. And so they took the seal of God and put it on these 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from each tribe.
So it's just those 144 that have the seal?
Yes. That's the only ones that have the seal. That's a seal for physical protection during the tribulation period. They won't die during the tribulation period, the 144,000.
They had to then believe in Jesus before they got the seal.
They would have to come to faith. Those 144,000 will come to faith somehow or another pretty quickly. I assume the Holy Spirit will woo them similar to now. They will come to faith, and they will be the witnesses to the earth of the gospel of the kingdom. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's a pronouncement that Jesus is about to return to earth. So those guys will be sealed for protection against physical death during the tribulation period. Other people will come to faith. They won't be the only ones that come to faith, but they'll actually live through the tribulation period. Linda.
Okay, with the fourth trumpet, the sun, moon, and stars will be darkened.
Yeah.
So plant life.
Absolutely.
Nothing can grow.
Yeah. Everything about those first four trumpets impacts the earth's ability to sustain life. Plant life, human life, animal life, any kind of life. Yeah, when the sun isn't shining for a third of the day, what kind of growing season are you going to have? Not much. Things, you could only grow things that grow quickly, you know, if anything at all. So all of a sudden now, the earth cannot sustain life like it does now. At least one third of its ability to sustain life is gone. So would you not think that maybe a third of the people can't get anything to eat anymore? We don't have a figure for that. They don't tell us how many deaths might result from that. But you got to believe it's a pretty big number when all of a sudden this planet can't grow things, can't produce fish in the oceans like it did. People that live off the oceans can't get their food. Fresh water, you can't get fresh water to drink or to process for the various things that you use it for. So all of a sudden now this planet isn't functioning like it has since the day of creation because of these judgments. Then you get the demons turned loose on man. One is just a tormentor. The other is a killer. 200 million horsemen to kill about 2 billion people is 10 guys each. Each of those critters, whatever they are. I was seeing something interesting online the other day, too, about sinkholes. They're finding these sinkholes that are hundreds of feet deep in various places around the world, with tall trees growing down in the bottom of them. You think, well, how many of those are there around? How many holes are there in the surface of the earth? The whole crust of the earth is only about 150 miles thick. But it looks like there's all kinds of holes in that crust somewhere where things can be housed and maybe come out of. So maybe that's where they come from. I don't know. But at any rate, then you have those two demon forces, and now we've accounted for, by specific statement, over half the world's population killed. And we don't even have numbers for most of these judgments. We just got those from two judgments out of our list here. So it is a time of extraordinary death and destruction. These trumpets look like they take place over the second half of the tribulation period, until you get down to about here, and then we're going to see later on another set of judgments called bowl judgments. They're associated with pouring something out of a bowl. They will take place right down here toward the end, and I'll explain to you why they have to be very short duration when we get into them. But so wars and earthquakes and things that we have a little bit of familiarity with for the first three and a half, then these extraordinarily phenomenal trumpet judgments over the second half, and the final blow will come from those bowl judgments a little later on. That's what we're seeing so far. Now, let's visit this question for a moment. Why do we care? Why do we give a hoot about these judgments, since we'll be going at the rapture and only somebody else will be experiencing these? It won't be us. It won't be believers, I should say. I shouldn't speak for anybody else, but if you're a believer, you'll go at the rapture and you won't go through any of this. What in the world does it matter to us? Well, Paul kind of sets an example for us and tells us, shows us something that I think helps us to understand and answer why it is we should care about this stuff. In Romans chapter 1, he says this, verse 14 and 15, says, I'm under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. Thus, for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you who are also in Rome. Why is Paul under an obligation to preach the gospel to anybody? He is already a believer. Just bit my tongue. That doesn't help. He doesn't care. It's no skin off of his nose if somebody else dies in disbelief. Why is he under obligation?
Probably
Christ came to save the world, not just a select few. So if we know, we should be out there witnessing and getting others to believe in Christ so that they won't have to suffer that either.
Well, are you saying that there are some things that if we possess, they are so valuable, we're obligated to share them with other people?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I agree with that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's what Paul is saying in essence, isn't he? He says he's under obligation to share the gospel with other people. Why? Because it is so invaluable. It is the way in which you escape these judgments that we're looking at here, God's plan of redemption, that he has to share it. He's obligated to share that. If you discovered a cure from cancer, would you just sit on it? Would you not feel obligated to relieve human suffering with that knowledge? Paul thinks he's obligated because he knows the gospel. Well, we know some things too, don't we? We know what awaits this Christ-rejecting world. We're studying it. We're seeing it in these numbers and in these descriptions. And as odd and as strange and as difficult as they are to grasp, we know what's going to happen to people. Most of them are going to die. We're seeing already in two specific ones, over half the world's population is going to die. And I showed you that argument before that I think more than 99% is going to die. We know that's coming. Your non-believing friends don't know that's coming necessarily. So maybe by you knowing what's coming, you, like Paul, are obligated to share it with them. Try to warn them of what's there. If you don't go at the rapture, for all intents and purposes, you're a dead man walking. You're not going to survive the tribulation period. Now, if you do, there's a little bit of an exception to that statement. The 144,000 will, plus some others will. But if the death rate is over 99%, like I think it is, most people will not survive it. And even if you did survive it, there's a separation of the righteous from the unrighteous prior to the millennial kingdom. You get thrown into the lake of fire at the end of it if you're still a non-believer. So if you don't go at the rapture, you can probably kiss yourself goodbye. You're done. You're toast. Nearly everyone is going to die. And if you do happen to make it through and you're still in a state of non-belief, you will be separated before the millennial kingdom is cranked up.
Aren't those 144,000 going to be productive at all?
Yes, yes, they will be. They'll be very productive. There'll be a lot of people believe.
Some people will make the transformation.
Yes, and a lot of them will be martyred. Most of the believers that come to faith during the tribulation period will be martyred. They'll be killed.
Yeah.
So yes, the good news is some will come to faith during that time, and maybe even a few will live through it. But the numbers are so low that you're kidding yourself to think that you can get through this impending judgment if you know anything at all about it. So our job, our duty, since we know this stuff, God left it here for us to learn ahead of time, our job is tell people what's coming. Man, they're standing on a set of railroad tracks and those lights coming at them is the train. So I think the reason we have this final warning to man, the last book in 66 books, is one last appeal to man to take advantage of God's great plan of redemption before you encounter God's great plan of judgment. And we are the possessors of that truth, and we are the people who should be the ones to share it with him. Remember what Paul told Timothy? He said, be ready in season and out of season, all of the time, at the drop of a hat, to share the gospel of God's grace with mankind. You could do the same thing with this gospel of judgment, if you want to call it that we're learning about through this book.
Does that fit into Christ's commandment of go and make disciples?
Yeah, it's all part of that standing order that we have. We have an obligation to the lost of this world to share the good news of God's gospel and the bad news of God's judgment that awaits those who reject God's gospel. So, the answer to the question, why should we give a hoot? Is because we're God's children and He's by grace called us into His family. He's equipped us with the knowledge of what He's doing both in terms of redemption and judgment. And we ought to share that with anybody who will listen to us. Now, you're going to have a hard time convincing anybody of what's going to take place. It's hard to believe from a believer's perspective, isn't it, the things we're seeing. 200 million rider army of demon-possessed critters killing 2 billion people. Try to sell that out on the street corner. These things are phenomenally difficult to grasp because of the nature of them. So, let's keep learning about what's going to happen, and let's keep a willing spirit to share these with anybody that will listen to us. Yeah, E.W.
In Daniel, he was revealed what was going to be the future of the nation Israel.
Mm-hmm.
70 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about the 70th week.
Mm-hmm.
Where does...
The other 69?
You know, nowhere the other 69 is. It's already happened.
Yeah.
I can't necessarily reconcile all you're telling me, all we're hearing, with the fact that everything you're saying applies to the Jews. Does that mean there's a 99% mortality rate in the nation of Israel?
Not necessarily within the nation of Israel, but in the world as a whole.
Oh, I understand.
We know that at least 2/3 of the Jews will die during the tribulation period from Zechariah chapter 12.
Okay.
So a bunch of them will die, but not all. But there ain't very many of them to begin with. There's only like 15 million Jews on the earth. So they're not a large percentage of the world population by any means. They're very, very, very small. And when I showed you that analysis that gets us to a death rate of greater than 99%, we assumed that there would be all of them left, and they're not. We purposefully biased it in favor of a death rate that's a little lower than it's really going to be. So it's unfortunately extraordinarily high. Okay, so just as kind of a check light from where we are, we want to continue sharing God's plan of judgment with men like we do God's plan of redemption and hopefully warn them of what's coming. Okay? All right, let's truck on from where we are this morning. We'll be in Revelation chapter 10. And we're introduced in this chapter to a little scroll. It's not the scroll we saw in chapter 6. Chapter 6 is a different word than the scroll here. This was a diminutive form of a scroll as compared to the one in chapter 6, which contains all these judgments. But let's look at this. Chapter 10, verse 1. I saw another strong angel coming down out of heaven, clothed with a cloud, and the rainbow was upon his head, and his face was like the sun, and his feet like pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book. This is not a scroll of chapter 6. This is a smaller version book. And it was open. So it's not sealed up like the other one was. And he placed his right foot on the sea and his left on the land, and he cried out with a loud voice as when a lion roars. And when he cried out, the 7 peals of thunder uttered their voices. So when this angel shouts out something, there are 7 peals of thunder that roar, and there's some verbal communication in those 7 peals of thunder. What are they? What was said? When the 7 peals of thunder had spoken, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up the things which the 7 peals of thunder have spoken, and do not write them. Oh. We don't have the whole story here, do we? No, there's some stuff that John was going to write down and give to us, and he was told not to. I wonder what that's about. I'll be dipped if I know. I don't know what that was.
We may not want to know.
Yeah, there's something there that was communicated to John and perhaps to the heavenly realm that we don't get. I don't know what it is. So we don't have the entire complete story of this judgment picture. We just have most of it. So not everything that God has up his judgment sleeve is known to man. And when the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land lifted up his right hand to heaven, he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and the things in it, and the earth and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, that there shall be delay no more. That is, guys, we're about to put a bow on this thing. This is not going to continue on. We're near the end of this thing. We're down, that seventh trumpet, when it sounds, it's almost over. The 7 years is almost complete. And in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, then the mystery of God is finished. That is God's program for man, and everything in it, Old Testament era, New Testament era, future, his revelation to mankind, it's finished. As he preached to his servants, the prophets, so these are the things that were known by them, and the voice which I heard from heaven, I heard again speaking with me, saying, go take the book which is open in the hand of the angel who stands on the sea and on the land. So this angel, whoever he was, he's got this little book. It could be Michael, the archangel. He's described here in some pretty magnificent terms. It's not the Lord, because the Lord doesn't swear by somebody else. He can only swear by himself. But John is told to go get that little book out of the hand of that angel. That book has some stuff in it that John needs to have and to understand. So I went to the angel, telling him to give me the little book. And he said to me, take it and eat it, and it will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. This is a book of judgment, isn't it? When you first read about God's judgment on mankind, you kind of respond by saying, good. Glad to see this happening. This godless world needs God to stomp on it. And I like that. Stomp on them, God. They deserve it. But then you meditate on that a little bit and you think, oh, no, wait a minute. What's going to be their end? A lake of fire? An eternity in conscious torment? The ultimate end game of the judgment of mankind is a horrible, horrible fact. So initially the concept of judgment is sort of sweet and we like it and we want it to happen, but then as we think through what the result of that is, it's a bitter sensation for the soul of man to think what's going to happen to so many of our fellow men. And I think that's what John is having described to him here. So I took the little book out of the angel's hand and I ate it. And it was in my mouth sweet as honey, and when I'd eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. He experienced exactly what we just described there. And they said to me, you must prophesy again concerning many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Now, John probably thought he was about done. He was down near that seventh trumpet, and he thought, well, we're getting ready to maybe wrap this thing up. We've worked our way down through this seven-year period of time through chapters 6 through 10, and we're down to about right here. And the angel says, John, you got to do it again, bud. You're not done. I want you to prophesy again about this same seven-year period of time. This time, I want you to feature the things he mentions there. Peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. So in addition to all of those events that we're seeing, and we haven't seen them all, we've just seen like about two-thirds of them, but in addition to all of those events, there are other things that people need to know about. Peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. There are all kinds of other players in that seven-year window that goes along with the whole picture, not just the events. And that's what John's going to tell us about next. So we've seen the major events, two-thirds of them. Now we're going to go back and we're going to learn about the major players, the major participants, and so on. You remember back in Daniel, We were introduced to a major player back there, weren't we? Remember what his name was?
The Antichrist.
Well, he was the Antichrist, but his previewer.
False prophet.
Remember Antiochus Epiphanes? That Syrian king who mimicked the Antichrist? He's a major player in this time frame, isn't it? We met him back there in chapter 7 and 8. And in chapter 11, we get all that history that traced us from his kingship all the way down to the Antichrist. So he is one case in point that John is going to tell us some things about. We've met him before in Daniel. We're going to meet him again here in the book of Revelation. The Antichrist, previewed to us by Antiochus Epiphanes. That's an example. Remember the 10 toes on the first vision in Daniel chapter 2, and later on the 10 horns and all this stuff? There's some kind of a 10-nation federation that's going to take place there, isn't it? We're going to talk about that again in this time frame. There are systems at work during the tribulation period, world systems that are controlled by the Antichrist, the economic system, the food chain, worship. We're going to learn about those too. So we're going to go back through the same time period again now and feature those things instead of the events. So we got a little bit of a reset here in chapter 10. You with me on this now? Okay. Tuck your events away for a little while. We'll come back and review them. We're going to go learn about some people's nations, tongues, and kings. Okay, let's learn about people's nations, tongues, and kings. Chapter 11. There was given to me a measuring rod like a staff. This would be probably about a 15 feet long pole that was used as a standard measuring device. Okay, it's 15 feet long, and you can go stick it along the walls and measure things like that. John is given one of those. And someone said, "Rise and measure the temple of God." What temple of God? I thought the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the last we knew. Oh, wait a minute. That ain't true. Because Zerubbabel came and rebuilt that sucker, didn't he? But then I think the Romans, I thought they destroyed that. And it's sort of an addition that Herod built in AD 70. I thought that one was destroyed in AD 70. It was. So what temple is he talking about here? Well, they're going to build another one. There's going to be a temple during the tribulation period. Who's going to be worshiping in that temple? The Jews are. This is the Jews' temple. All right? They're going to build another one right here. And that's the one that's being referred to here in Revelation chapter 11. God says, I want you to go measure this thing. The temple and the altar and those who worship in it. And this concept of measuring something is sort of a manifestation of ownership. God is saying, in effect, he owns this temple. These are his people. This is his system of worship that's going to exist during the tribulation period. Well, how are the Jews going to pull that off with all the Arabs over there that are going to try to stop them at every chance they possibly get? How are they going to pull off building a temple on the temple grounds during this time? Well, we're going to see that in just a bit. But it says, leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the nations. That is, the outer part of this thing the Gentiles will occupy, and they'll tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. How many years is 42 months? 3.5. Is that ringing any bells? Does 3.5 sound like anything we've heard before during this time frame? Yeah, the Gentiles will trample Jerusalem down, beginning in the middle of the tribulation period to the end of it. But in the first half, their temple will stand. We see what will happen at the middle of it. We'll talk about that in a bit. And I will grant authority to my two witnesses that they will prophesy for 1260 days clothed in sackcloth. How long is 1260 days? 3.5 years. We're tripping over 3.5 years, aren't we? So God is going to equip some witnesses that are associated with this temple. I think it's here at the first half. We'll talk about this. And these two witnesses are going to witness of something during that first 3.5 years. And these guys are especially equipped to take care of themselves. If anyone desires to harm them, these two witnesses, fire proceeds out of their mouth and devours their enemies. We got some fire-breathing dragons all over the place in this book, don't we? These two guys can also breathe fire. They can take care of themselves. If anybody tries to hurt them, they'll just cook them right on down. They'll just burn them up. These two guys cannot be killed at first. They have the power to shut up the sky in order that rain may not fall during the days of their prophesying. Adding to all of this other stuff now is the fact that these guys can stop it from raining for 3.5 years. I don't know if that means worldwide or locally or what, but they've got the power to stop rain. They'll have the power over the waters to turn them into blood. Well, that would be good. What little fresh water you can find, these guys can turn it to blood. And to smite the earth with every plague as often as they desire. Wow. These are not your average guy on the street. These two witnesses are equipped by God to sustain themselves and to add to the judgment of mankind through their skills and their abilities. Who the heck are these two guys? Well, the most popular votes are, that you'll find anywhere, go to dead guys. Elijah, Moses, Enoch. Why do they need to be dead guys? I wonder. They don't need to be dead guys. That's why. They're just guys. Are they dead guys that God brings back? Is he going to bring back Elijah? He could withhold rain. He knows how to do that. He's already been taught. Is he going to bring back Moses? He knows how to turn the water to blood. He already knows how to do that. Maybe Enoch? Enoch never bit the big one. He was translated. He's never died. Maybe he has to come back and die. Maybe Elijah has to come back and die, and Enoch has to come back and die, because there's a verse in Hebrews that says it's appointed for man to die once, and then there's the resurrection. Think that's what they're talking about? Well, that context has got nothing to do with men having to die once, and it has to do with the unlimited atonement of the death of Christ. Plus, how many people are not going to die at the rapture? So that argument doesn't hold any water. I don't think you can argue that this has to be two men that haven't died yet so they can come back and die. In this book, you never say never. Well, I don't think that's the best answer we can come up with, is Enoch and Elijah. Moses already died. He gets a lot of votes anyway because of that turning water into blood stuff. Maybe that's who it is. I can't say that it ain't for positively sure, but it doesn't need to be a dead guy. We've seen this pattern before. We've seen the pattern of a temple being rebuilt by Jewish leaders that God protects and uses as witnesses of his ability to accomplish his will right under the noses of his enemies. We've seen that before, haven't we? You remember this? You remember this time frame right here? 70 years after the Babylonian captivity, people came back from Babylon and rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem back here. And the leadership of that rebuild was under two people. A political leader of the day, his name was Zerubbabel. He was like the governor of Judea, let's call him. And the other leader was the religious leader of the day, the high priest. His name was Joshua. Not the Joshua that followed Moses, but a different Joshua. So there were two guys associated with the rebuild of this temple back here that God referred to in Zechariah chapter 4 as lampstands and witness. What's that?
Lampstands and olive trees.
Yes. Zechariah chapter 4 is the record of this. And by the way, if you're ever interested in Jewish post-exilic study, the three historical books are Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And the three prophetic books are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So those six books cover all of the post-Babylonian exile history and prophetic history of Israel. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those are your six books. Well, in... where was I headed? Is Ezra that I was heading, wasn't it? Yeah. I was going to show you that those guys that rebuilt that temple were very, very much in the same role as the guys we are seeing here. So you go back into Ezra chapter 4. And you're introduced to these two guys, Zerubbabel and Joshua. And they're referred to by the same basic terms that these two guys are referred to in Revelation chapter 11. The same basic thing. So the role that they played there, the two olive trees and the two lampstands in Zechariah 4 is the same description given of these two guys here during the tribulation period. Back in Zerubbabel's day, back here, two witnesses that witnessed to God's ability to provide for his people right under the noses of their enemies. The enemies of Israel back here tried to stop this build. They tried to kill off these people and stop it in every way they can. So these guys, these two witnesses here, are playing the exact same role as what we're seeing here in Revelation chapter 11. They're going to be, somebody's going to be, it looks like, the leaders of building the new temple during the tribulation period. Two guys. And the Jews are going to do everything they can to stop it. And God says, you can't stop me. I can do this right in your face, right under your nose, and that's what I am going to do. So he's going to rebuild the temple under the leadership of two witnesses in the tribulation period, just like he did before following the Babylonian captivity. Did you follow that argument? Did you follow that history? Why can't these two witnesses just be the two guys of that day who oversee the building of the temple like they did during Zerubbabel's day? That present-day governor of Judea, the mayor of Jerusalem, whoever the political guy is, and whoever the religious leader is. So those two guys that will oversee the building of the temple here could be these same two witnesses that it was before. Doesn't have to be dead guys come back. Maybe it is dead guys come back. I'm not saying it ain't. I'm just saying we don't have to grasp quite that far back when we're going to have two men leading this effort right in the Arabs' face, right under their nose. They're going to hate everything about this because these two guys are going to witness to God's ability to provide for his people right under their noses. So my opinion is, I think it's probably more sensible to just understand them as being those two leaders of that day, the political leader and the religious leader, who will oversee the building of the tabernacle or the temple during the tribulation period. Follow that line of reasoning? Maybe right, maybe wrong, I don't know. But that's who I think they are instead of the dead guys brought back. But it could be the other guys could be involved as well. But there's more about them. Let's go on. We're not going to be able to nail down their identity for certain, but we can learn more about them. When they finish their testimony, that'll be 3.5 years, the beast that comes up out of the abyss, we've seen him before, but we're going to see him again in chapter 13. The beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. Now, they couldn't be killed for 3.5 years, could they? Anybody tried to hurt them, they just burn them up. But there will come an end to that 3.5 year ministry, and at that time, they will be killed. Midpoint of the tribulation period, I think, is when these guys will be killed. And we'll talk about a bunch of stuff that will happen at the midpoint of the tribulation period before we're done. But that's when they're killed. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom in Egypt, where also the Lord was crucified. This is Jerusalem, of course. So they won't even get a decent burial. Their enemies, the enemies of God, the people that have tried to stop them for 3.5 years and couldn't, they'll just let them lay in the street. Let them lay there and rot. Let the birds come along and peck their eyes out or whatever else they do. And those from the people and tribes and tongues and nations will look at their dead bodies for 3.5 days and will not permit their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. That's how base the society is. They will be so relieved that these guys are dead that they'll let them lay out in the weather for 3.5 days and presumably start to rot. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry. This is the only mention in the book of Revelation of merriment. The only mention of joy on the planet during the tribulation period is the reaction to the death of these two witnesses. And they'll send gifts to one another. It'll be Christmas in July. Because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. Their message is that God is able to deliver us even in your face, enemies of God. And when they finally are killed, people will rejoice over that death. They think that testimony is over and done and does not torment them anymore. But after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God came into them. God is going to resurrect these two guys back to, looks like normal natural life here. And they stand on their feet. Great fear fell among those who were beholding them. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." Two more translations, it looks like. That is, like Enoch, like Elijah, these guys will be called to heaven, having never died themselves. So if you got to get two guys to come back to die, how does that work out? It doesn't look like they died at all. They were just temporarily dead, like Lazarus, but raised back to physical life, and God calls them home. And they went up into heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. Isn't it remarkable how, even in the face of these divine examples of divine control and so on, people just ignore it? Here's two guys that have been dead for 3.5 days. They just get up and God just calls them to heaven and people see it. They ain't there anymore on the ground. They've risen into heaven. And they don't care. And in that hour there was a great earthquake and a tenth of the city fell. This is Jerusalem we're talking about. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake and the rest were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. Now, do you know that Israel is sitting on a fault line? That Jerusalem's on a fault line? Here's another shot of the earth tectonic plates again. Well, right over here, this Arabian plate and the African plate, the fault line between the two of them goes right through Jerusalem. So it is no great surprise that there's an earthquake in Jerusalem and that 7,000 people could die from that earthquake. That's almost predictable. These plates all want to turn counterclockwise. This plate wants to go like this. This plate wants to go like that. So this side of the plate wants to go up. This side of this plate wants to come down. So forces are doing this right along that fault line. And so it looks like God just lets one rip there. And 7,000 people will die in that earthquake that's associated with these guys' resurrection. The second woe is past. Behold, the third woe is coming quickly. We haven't seen the third woe yet. Remember, the last three trumpets are all called woes. We haven't seen that third one, but we're about to. And when that trumpet, that seventh trumpet, is about to sound, there is an announcement. The seventh trumpet sounded, and there rose loud voices in heaven, saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever." You ever heard that before in Psalm? Yeah. Handel should be charged with plagiarizing the Word of God. He can't do that. Now, it looks like he's probably where he got his course for Messiah, didn't he? What this announcement is saying is that, guys, it's over. Satan's realm, Satan's kingdom, is now being transferred over to the Son of God. All of his power and authority and reigning over the prince and power of the air for these last 6,000 years is over when the seventh trumpet sounds, and Christ is going to assume authority over his, Satan's old realm. And he will reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders who sit on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, "We give thee thanks, O Lord God Almighty, who art and was, because thou hast taken thy great power and hast begun to reign." It is spoken of as though Christ has taken over at the sounding of the seventh trumpet. But there's still a little bit more to go on, but I think it's going to happen very, very quickly, like maybe in a matter of few weeks at most, maybe a month or two at most, maybe a few days. It's about all over when the seventh trumpet sounds. "And the nations were enraged, and thy wrath came, and the time came for the dead to be judged, and the time to give their reward to their bondservants and prophets and to the saints and to those who fear thy name, and the small and the great, you destroy those who destroy the earth. And the temple of God, which is in heaven, was opened." Well, there's a temple in heaven, isn't there? And that's the one after which the tabernacle was patterned in Moses' day. And God told Moses, when you build this thing, you build it exactly like I told you. Don't deviate in any way. Don't take any architectural license here. I want this to be exactly like the one in heaven. Build it like I tell you. It's because there's one there. "And that was opened, and the ark of his covenant appeared in his name." What's that got to do with anything? What's that box all about all of a sudden? Well, in that ark, that covenant represents God's Mosaic or his Abrahamic commitment to his people, and he's about to come and institute that messianic kingdom. That box is associated with the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, which is about to take place when Christ comes back and sets up his kingdom here on earth. So that box is very much relevant to these events that are taking place. And there appeared in his temple, and there were flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder and a great earthquake and a great hailstorm. So other celestial signs that will be associated with the sounding of that seventh trumpet. That seventh trumpet pretty much marks the end. It's pretty much all over but the shouting when that seventh trumpet sounds. But there's a little bit more. That shouting hasn't happened yet. And when you see what's involved in that, you'll be blown away by that as well. But that's very much near the end. So the seventh trumpet essentially says, it's over, guys. And I'm going to finish you off here in just a little bit. And that will be the end of it. So you have the first half seal judgments. Second half trumpet judgments that get you all the way down to just almost the very end. And we got this little sliver of bowl judgments that we'll talk about before we're done. All right, following the events, still there's a bunch more to go. We're not done with the nations, tongues, peoples, and kings. We're not done with the events, either one yet. But we're getting pretty close. The seventh trumpet gets us down nearly to the end of the tribulation period. What do you think? Does it all make sense? God's great plan of judgment of godless men is just as impressive and involved as God's great plan of redemption for men. God's plan of redemption is the means by which you escape God's plan of judgment. His plan of judgment can have a temporal facet to it, and we're seeing that here. That's what we're studying. And of course, it's got that eternal aspect to it, which is eternity in conscious torment. Both aspects of his plan of judgment can be escaped by accepting his plan of redemption. But if you ignore his plan of redemption, you will be the recipient of his plan of judgment, both temporally and eternally. Two great plans that God has for mankind. And he's warning us in this book of the dangers associated with ignoring his plan of redemption, because this is what awaits those that do, his plan of judgment, both temporally and eternally. Questions or comments over what we've seen so far? We ain't done. More to come. We're going to see some more major players. Jerry, do you have a question?
Well, but for those who have been exposed to the gospel and rejected, I always understood they didn't get a second chance.
Well, there's a good reason to understand that, because God tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, that because people rejected the truth, he's going to send them this, he calls it it's a spirit of stupor in Romans. It's a it's kind of a brain fog, kind of a spiritual brain fog, and people will be inclined to believe a lie. So you can't just say, well, I'll just wait until I see this stuff start to happen, and I'll sign up, because you may not be able to sign up. So that's a point that people do need to know about and keep in mind. That's not an escape hatch. That escape hatch may be locked closed. People can't get out of that judgment if they take that approach. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Any other questions or comments? Walter.
I'm not sure if I were in the tribulation, I'd want to live through it.
Yeah, that's right. That's another perspective I have. And you're not going to most of the time. Go ahead, Walter.
What room we meeting in next week?
I think we're supposed to be in here again next week. That was my original understanding. It was last week and next week. This week came up a surprise. I think the school wanted to rehearse and practice some more things, and so they're doing it down there, not in mass, but I think small pieces are working down there. So sorry that you all have to walk so far.
No problem.
And we can't get in down here because the teachers are all parked out here by the door. So you got to walk down there to get in. So, but plan on being here, and I'll send you out a message, a reminder, just to make sure. Okay, we'll let you roll, and we'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing.